Hello, Food Chain. This is Sharon Chittone, and I'm a food tech junkie and innovation nerd who loves a good story. This podcast combines all of my favorite vices into a deep dive about the problems our food system faces and the visionary people working on solutions. Today with us, we're honored to have Professor Mark Tester from Iris and Kaust in Saudi Arabia. Professor Tester is a pioneering figure in agricultural science, has been at the forefront of developing sustainable agricultural solutions designed to thrive in some of the world's harshest environments. With his groundbreaking work, he's turning the tide on how we think about food production in arid climates using minimal freshwater resources. Join us as we explore how his innovations are shaping the future of food security and sustainability. Are you ready? Here we go. Hi, Mark. How are you?
It's good to see you again, Sharon. I'm fine. Thank you.
Good to see you. Where are you calling from today?
I'm in Saudi Arabia at King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, where there's this high-tech university supporting a lot of science and technology, including in the food and environment space.
And we'll dive into that in just a short minute. But can you share a little bit about your journey and how that influenced your career and led you to what you're doing today?
Well, when I was a student, I discovered I was a plant guy and I'm just natural with plants. And so I was curiosity driven for a long time, just wanting to understand how plants work and how some plants can grow in some places and other plants grow in other places. So I was very interested in the adaptation of plants to their environment. And then I wanted to apply the privilege of my knowledge to something of, I thought, importance to the environment and humans. And so I started to study salinity tolerance and try to understand how some plants grow better in saline soils than others, and then try to apply that knowledge to try to improve the growth of crops in substandard soil conditions. And been pretty much doing that ever since. And I think what's interesting is as I've moved, you know, from Australia to Cambridge, back to Australia, and now here in Saudi Arabia, I've been progressively moving towards not only just trying to apply my research, but actually truly delivering my research outcomes as well. And that's been a nice journey.
Yes. So you're Australian. I can hear the accent.
I can turn it on if you want a lot more.
And so basically you're working, you mentioned you're at Kaust right now. I had the pleasure of learning about it, which is an impressive institution. Can you just give us a little overview of the university, the program, your accelerators? You guys do a lot of stuff.
It's a new university. It's 15 years old. It was founded with a pretty remarkable vision of King Abdullah, who wanted to rekindle sciences or rekindle the sciences in the Islamic world. That was the big picture. It's a graduate-only university, so we have research students and researchers. It's very small with just 200 faculty, roughly 200 faculty, and about 2,000 students, I think the number is. So it's very focused on science and technology. There are four pillars, which are sort of food, water, energy, environment. Interestingly, not medicine. That's been introduced a little bit more recently, but really the dominant areas are these range of applied sciences, which is a fantastic environment for a plant guy like me who's trying to apply his work to land myself in. The university's massive investment from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and increasingly the Saudi Arabian government is wanting to see some returns back. So we're under quite a bit of pressure to not just do nice science, but also to apply that. I'm fine with that. I'm lucky because I can really feed my research into things that are relevant for the kingdom. But of course, if we're doing things that are benefiting the kingdom, that will benefit the region or benefit like arid zones throughout the planet, in which over 1 billion people live and encompass a very wide geography. So the university, there are many ways you can apply your science and deliver, I should say, your science. And in fact, I think the proudest legacy I have are the students, and education is an incredibly important legacy, which I think is sometimes undervalued, but we're certainly very engaged with Saudi Arabian students and with young Saudi women in particular. And I think that's a very important pathway for delivery. More immediately tangible pathways include things like doing consulting and being asked questions and answering those questions when coming from Saudi industry or government. And then, of course, we could also interact with industry more directly with research programs. And that can be with the major companies, the really big ones like SABIC and Saudi Aramco, or it can be with mid and small size companies as well. And then, of course, there are spin outs. And certainly I've had very direct experience with that pathway.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fairly trendy way of doing things at the moment. I think it's a very valid pathway for delivering your science as well. You can be more nimble, more flexible, faster, more responsive. And the opportunities are huge, but it's very high risk as well, of course. The valley of death kills off many, many small enterprises, many of which are very good and worthy and could actually become businesses, but they just can't quite get over the line. That's a problem with this spin-out model. But I mean, some of the selection is also Darwinian on a well-founded basis that the company actually isn't as viable as perhaps the academic or the keen students might fantasize. But Kouster is great because it does give good, real support, both cash and in kind support for the establishment of companies. And so we've got a much higher chance of getting through that valley of death in this environment and having a chance of getting out there and doing some delivery that way as well.
Which, as you said, you have direct experience, and we'll get into that in a minute, because you did launch a successful, very successful company yourself. But try to bring this together. Why, I would say, and it's great, the environment, food, climate, energy, you know, that's food systems are made out of those and touch onto those. But why is it important for the Middle East to really work onto these key topics?
The giant in the room was the one thing you didn't mention, in addition to people, is water. And water is the giant. So globally, two-thirds, three-quarters of all the water humans use is for putting that food on your plates, in particular for growing plants, in particular for irrigation. And it's maybe a third of all the food that we consume is done under irrigation. And that's a pretty daunting realization, especially when so much of the water that is used for irrigation now is coming from underground. And every aquifer that is being used for agriculture is being depleted. So we are unsustainably mining a lot of underground water for the production, large fraction of the food that we eat. And so sustainability issues are obviously very significant. Future food security implications could be very large as well. And of course, when we're in the Middle East, the thumbs get even more extreme. So we're not talking of two-thirds, three-quarters, maybe 85% of the water being used in this region is contributing to crop growth and food, the production of food. And that's even just a small fraction of the total food that's required in this region. So by many different analyses, it's quite precarious here for food security. Of course, there's a huge buffer, especially at the moment, because the countries are wealthy because of oil, the black runny stuff that has fueled a lot of economic growth in the last 100 years. And so the importation of food is enormous and shows no sign of diminishing. So there is a buffer here. But even so, there's still, especially for things like fresh fruit and vegetables, the transport of those needs to be rapid because their shelf lives are quite small. And spending a lot of money on the transport of fresh fruit and vegetables economically viable, at least in the short term, because they're high value produce. You know, so for the tons of produce you're moving, it's worth a lot of money. So that extra cost incurred on transport is not noticed so much by the consumer, but it comes with a big carbon footprint. And really, you can have a really big impact on sustainability of your food system, or the environmental impact, perhaps might be a better word, the environmental impact of your food system if you're growing fresh fruits and vegetables locally. And so this is something which is, I think, realized in the Middle East, and there's certainly an increased desire to do this. There's also a little bit of fear that you get things like political instabilities, international warfare, even events like the blocking of the ship in the Suez Canal, which was like a year ago for a week. That really put some tremors into quite a lot of Asian systems. And in the Middle East, it was definitely, it's a relatively minor event, yet with really quite a significant, certainly psychological impact. And so there's still a desire as well, and I think a misguided desire, but there's certainly a big drive for improving food security through improving food self-sufficiency. And people, you know, again, it's psychological and it's understandable, but I don't think it's correct. But a lot of people think that if you're self-sufficient, then you're more secure. And the food system is much, much more complex than that. As I argue for sustainability and for a level of security, local production of fresh fruit and vegetables, and even meat, dairy, local production can be highly beneficial. But for the staples of life, for our wheat and barley and rice, you know, for our potatoes and for our pulses, you really can grow them in a lot of different places and ship them, long shelf life, low transport costs, low carbon emissions from transporting huge amounts of your wheat. And you need a system which has got diversity of sourcing, large amounts of storage, local storage. You know, I'm talking years of storage and a very, you know, top quality management, storage and management system to reduce loss and waste while storing large amounts of this thing. So you've got to at least produce it. So you can buffer, you can build in a big buffer, which does give you security. And I would argue very strongly gives you a lot more security than trying to produce locally.
But what about biodiversity when you produce the big staples, right? It's always wheat and soy and rice and potatoes.
Yes.
So what about biodiversity
Yes.
there?
Well, I mean, there's a cruel fact that there's a very high population that's living with a higher quality of life than ever in human history. And 40% of our food, at least of our calorific intake, comes from just three species of plants. And there's a very strong reason for that, because it is unbelievably efficient. It's very, very high tonnage per hectare, very, very low cost per ton. And it's a remarkable outcome of remarkable plant breeding and agronomy. It's genetics and agronomy hand in hand, has developed a system which is, it has enabled the world population to be what it is. And other factors are going to come in and limit the growth of world population in time. But between now and then, we have to get through without mass starvations. And we haven't had a famine of scale for 30 years. Again, this is a remarkable success of the human built food system, which is largely based on wheat, rice, and maize. What we need to be able to do for biodiversity, well, there's two things. We need to think about biodiversity in terms of planetary sustainability. We also need to think about biodiversity in terms of global food security. So being so reliant on such a small number of species does put one in a very vulnerable position. And of course, for the planetary ecosystem stability, you need diversity. Especially as we're facing the very real perils, very real challenges of global It's often called global climate change. I do prefer to think of it as global environmental change, where, of course, increasing CO2 emissions massively, but there's huge other impacts us humans are making on the environment. Habitat fragmentation is one of them, which is just like never before in history. And also the nitrogen cycle is way more than doubled its natural historical levels. So there's a huge amount more nitrogen in the systems, which really does perturb ecosystems, shifts things out of balance, promotes weedy species and so on much more. Now, weeds are a huge issue globally. You go into a lot of systems which are preserved, which are national parks, and a lot of their biodiversity and conservation potential is being eroded through weed invasion. And this is no coincidence. There's a lot more substrates out there now for promoting plant growth, nitrogen, CO2 being two of them. Yeah. So weedy species really are, I think, a major issue as well. So for biodiversity, we have to preserve this biodiversity. And this is something which is very, for me, it's naively sad, because we really have to manage our systems. I mean, where is the wilderness on the planet now? Everywhere is managed. Even the wilderness is being managed by humans, has been impacted by humans and being managed by humans who are trying to reduce the detrimental effects of impacts. So we have to, as humans, put energy, resources in to actively preserving biodiversity in national parks, in semi-wild, semi-wilderness places globally. We have to do this on our agricultural systems. Yes, we have to diversify our agricultural system base. We have, thanks to plant breeding and agronomy, we have luxury, of being able to do this over this next few decades, bring in new crops like quinoa, and there are many minor grains, the millets, for example. There are many, multiple species of millets, which have got massive potential for improvement. So we have to do that over these next 10, 20 years, and that will improve the robustness of our food system.
I'm a big proponent of the sort of the high-tech, low-tech combination of things, right?
100% right. High-tech development, low-tech delivery.
Yeah. The Middle East has many challenges. The world, as we just discussed, has many challenges. The work that people like yourself are doing, that, yes, you're focusing Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, but then with the global outlook, because of course you guys are, there's a very diverse group of scientists coming from all over the world with many different backgrounds, which is great, right? So how, let's say, what are the, I would say, Saudi Arabia's efforts and initiatives in promoting this sustainable agriculture, food system, water, tech, desert tech, to overall the achievement of food security? And how does your work align with these national goals?
Well, the national goals are fairly inwardly looking. I don't think, to be honest, Saudi Arabia is making huge efforts to have a global influence, but they will. And I think they also do almost by accident. And that doesn't sound very courteous, but I think just places like you've just described, KAUST is an international place which has 40% Saudi students. And in our division of biological sciences, I think 60% female. And this is fantastic. Young Saudis are the future of this country. There's some fantastic young people here doing fantastic work. And the Saudi food system is quite small because of the large reliance on importation. It's going to remain small because there's no water. There's no sustainable sources of water. The average rainfall here is 80 millimeters nationally. So we've got 2.15 million square kilometers of land, average rainfall 80 millimeters. That's not much water.
No, we're a big country.
What's big in area? It's modest in population. It's only 32 million people in population. Census figures were just published a few months ago. Look, there's going to be some good things done, plant and agricultural science and for marginal lands. And these will inevitably have benefits seeping out through Middle East, West Asia, North Africa, arid zones more widely. And as I say, that's 1 billion people. And I think especially for fresh fruit and vegetables, and I think local meat production as well, I think we can make some significant contributions to increasing the sustainability of those food systems. I really don't think we have a profound food security issue. We do have a profound sustainability issue. The carrying capacity of the rangelands of Saudi Arabia, the rangelands occupy 70% of the area of Saudi Arabia. Okay. They can probably have in the order of maybe 1.7 million cattle head equivalents. So where 5 sheep is 1 cattle head equivalent. That's probably about the number that this land could carry. And the actual number of cattle head equivalents in Saudi Arabia is over 7 million. It's way over the carrying capacity. It's horrifying. So what little vegetation is here has been grazed into the dust. It's absolutely not sustainable. We have to develop systems for reducing the pressure, the grazing pressure on the systems here. So for thousands of years, there's been social-based systems of self-control, which probably developed through ecological observations. They noticed people thousands of years ago, noticed if they overgrazed, that they then, the grandchildren are saying, grand grazed too many cattle and now we're really struggling. So systems were developed for self-limitation and that's gone. And it's really a critical situation, which is a consequence of the increase in population and increase in quality of life. And these things have to be, we have to develop systems, with more sustainable production of meat. I don't eat meat, but most people do. And unfortunately, personally, and so we have to support more sustainable eating meat or meat-like protein.
Indeed, production, livestock in general, right? And I think that's another place where innovation can play a huge role with these alternatives where we should push farmers or livestock farmers to farm in better ways, more sustainable ways, more regenerative ways, and the rest we can do in other methods, right?
Yes, we're going to have to, as a planet, we're going to have to use more alternative protein sources, so whether that's microbial, fungal, or some plant-based. Right? So there's still definitely more options for more growth in plant-based protein. But I think microbial protein's inevitably going to be required.
We talked a little bit about the world, Saudi Arabia, and we mentioned before how you co-founded a company within KAUST, Red Sea Farms, which is, I think, it has a very impactful mission. Can you tell us a little bit about the company? What's the story behind it? And what's the vision?
Yes, Red Sea Farms was actually, it's now called Red Sea. It's the current company is formed from the merger of primarily two main companies. And there's a couple of other little companies as well that have become part of Red Sea. But it was founded by three people in KAUST. So it's definitely a KAUST spin out, which had the bringing together of a material scientist, Daria Baran, and Ryan Lafers, who's an engineer, an agricultural engineer specializing in water, and myself, the plant guy. And so you have the three different sciences, the three different sets of technologies coming in. And that was almost single-handedly why the company was successful. We're very focused on definitely ensuring we develop stuff for which there is a market. No market, no business, no business, no company. But we've got the buffering and we can cover each other by having the three different technologies all together, especially in these early perilous days of companies. So we've got through our first 5 years by supporting each other. And my work is trying to help develop plants which can grow in marginal areas, in particular saline water or saline soils. Ryan was working on developing systems for cooling greenhouses using salt water, even seawater rather than fresh water. And then Daria has in particular invented, she's a very, very brilliant young woman. She invented some nanoparticles, which are able to absorb in the near infrared and have a huge impact on reducing heat load coming in to greenhouses or other protected systems, even under netting. So the three of us were all working on systems where we were trying to reduce the requirement for expensive inputs or of environmentally impactful inputs for the production of our food. We were trying to substitute fresh water with salt water. Dairy was trying to reduce the need for using water and electricity for cooling the greenhouse. And so we developed this company where the primary remit was to use technologies, to use technological advances, to develop them and to deliver them with the aim of reducing the environmental footprint of our food production. That's the company. And that's still 100% our remit and our focus is to use nanotechnology, use engineering, use IT. I didn't mention IT, but we can use the Internet of Things, sensors, and the gathering of large amounts of data and the analysis of large amounts of data to improve our efficiencies of management of our agricultural systems. That's one of the most impactful of all the technologies. Or to use the plant genetics to try to improve the ability of plants to grow with fewer inputs or with lower quality inputs like salty water. And so between us, we're able to, yeah, I think very genuinely reduce the need for fresh water and reduce the CO2 emissions through reduced energy requirements of agricultural systems. We started with protected environments, but some of our work sort of almost accidentally is also relevant to open fields. In particular, my plant work actually may end up being more relevant to open field systems than controlled environment systems. But as a business, we've been able to develop, and these things have developed at different rates. So Daria is the superstar of the company at the moment because her work is already out there. We have millions of dollars of sales, multi-millions of dollars of sales annually because of Daria's heat blocking, which is, you know, it's good science, but it's also very rapidly deliverable, sort of a bit by luck if we're being honest, but we're going to take it because often those plastic coverings in greenhouses get replaced quite frequently. And so it's easy, and her technology was cheap as well. It's easy to disperse her nanoparticles into the plastic. And so there's a low barrier for adoption by farmers who are intrinsically very conservative. They're working in a very difficult system. So very risk averse. And Daria's technology is easy for them to take on board and adopt, and they are. So it's very, very rapid impact. In the meantime, my plant stuff's coming along behind, and I'm saying, well, I've almost got it through some registration processes. Plants take time to grow and test and validate. And so I'm coming along behind Daria, who's out there. She's out there really with multiple sales. And then I'll come along behind and then be able to support soon, next year.
Okay. So, yes, you need obviously capital to continue developing and innovating. And so that's just part of the business.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And you mentioned price. I think price is very important. Absolutely. Because obviously farmers are not ones that make the big bucks, right? And the value chain. So being mindful of that is extremely important. Yes. And obviously all these solutions could be used anywhere in the world. So it's not necessarily a MENA.
We're making a lot more sales out of MENA than in MENA. Adoption's been very, very rapid. Mexico, Spain, US, Portugal, China. I don't know how. Egypt, I think even India, Australia. Anywhere where it's hot, this stuff is useful and is really penetrating the market rapidly. It is amazing. Yeah, yes. Heaps of stuff outside.
That's great.
Yeah.
And so right now you've been in business for a few years now. What growth stage are you at? Like a Series A, Series?
Yeah, I mean,
it's all on Crunchbase, so the numbers are there in public. I'm not sure we've announced our Series A, but we are definitely well through that process. And so, yeah,
and it's all,
yeah, we're in rapid growth phase.
Right.
So we're not profitable, but we do have, yes, multi-millions of dollars of revenue this year. We really only started really serious sales about March, end of March this year. So we're certainly grossing quite significant.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, big growth
rapid
this year.
Rapid growth
then.
This year. And we expect that to maybe triple sales next year. So yes, the second half of this year and then next year will be the big growth phase. Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I guess this ties into also when we started this interview, you said that one of the key areas of your expertise was in sort of the salinity tolerance. And also you mentioned it now with Red Sea Farm, with Red Sea. Why is that important?
Yes. Well,
and what is it for?
Well, salinity tolerance is fairly important. It does affect, you know, a very large fraction of soils globally, like 20% of the soils or something, have plant growth significantly affected by salinity. And it's one of the traits. I mean, people say, oh, drought's much more important. Actually, drought's much more complex. I argue there's no such thing as drought per se. There's all sorts of different types of drought. And that makes trying to address drought, it's actually very difficult for a plant scientist because you need different genetics for different types of drought. You need different types of plants for different types of drought. Salinity is a little bit more of a universal, I mean, I'm simplifying a bit, but it's a fairly universal type of stress on the plants, like heat. Heat's another very important stress. Cold is another important stress. So plants have got a lot to handle out there. And of course, pests and diseases are extremely important as well, arguably more so than many of the abiotic stresses. So really, you need to develop the plant genetics to be able to just have a fighting chance and continue to have a reasonable level of productivity in the face of a whole series being of bombardments of different types of stresses. And what we've done is, yeah, okay, I focus on salinity tolerance as making my small contribution, but we're actually, and it was thanks to Red Sea, I have to say, in the process of me under the pressure of commercial reality needing to develop and deliver some of these traits into crops, I developed a new type of, I guess, genetics. Don't want to sound too self-important, but I'm genuinely very excited about it. And for an old guy, it's nice to still get excited and still, hey, wow, I had a new idea. And this, actually, so I've had probably the best idea of my career. I had actually during lockdown. And so we've been able to develop a new type of genetics where we're able to rapidly combine multiple traits, to produce a new type of genetic material. And the limitation with the genetics is that it's really only applicable for rootstocks. So when you're developing something that you're going to put in your mouth and eat, there's a whole range of other things that you have to consider. But if we just consider the bottom half of the plant, the lower half of the plant, then you've got a lot more opportunity to do some moderately crazy things. But if you're going to do some moderately crazy things, then you've got to be able to combine traits efficiently. So it was just my brain just put together actually four different processes, all of which are established as processes, but combining them together turned out to be pretty much unique. But only applicable for when you're grafting plants. So I can now develop beautiful rootstocks and really interesting original rootstocks that have big impacts on yields for plants which are grafted. So we were talking earlier about wheat, rice, corn, maize. Mm-hmm. But there's actually a huge amount of the food that we eat is not those three species, but are things like tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers and all the nuts, all the things like the apples and most of the fruits that we eat are grown on trees, which are grafted. They're already grafted. And what we've done is develop a method for new types of rootstocks, which are really gangbuster rootstocks. And so we're now going as fast as we can to impact and deliver, yes, salinity tolerance, but a load of other traits as well. And into, yes, it was all thought up originally with tomatoes, and we were working with tomatoes as the world's biggest horticultural crop by a mile, but now it's also applicable to peppers and eggplants, which feed a lot of people, and then the cucumbers, pumpkins, watermelons, and so on, which is a very important crop as well. Pumpkins are amazing. And then all of those perennial trees, almonds and walnuts, grapevines, and so on.
Amazing.
And what's interesting is there's an incredible institute, it's an organization which did a very authoritative and thorough analysis about world food, what's needed and what's being provided and what's being wasted. Mm. That's another whole issue for discussion. And they said, look, if we eat what we should eat rather than what we do eat, like we eat about three times as much meat as we actually is good for us, if we eat less fat, so if we eat what we should eat rather than what we do eat, and if we halve the waste, so these are two sort of conditionals in this particular analysis, but they're not unreasonable conditionals. If we do that, we're already producing enough starchy materials, so grains, potatoes, and so on. We're already producing enough of those to feed the planet in 2050. So it's already a massive excess of production of starchy matter on the planet already, but there's nowhere near enough production of the food that's actually good for us, the healthy stuff. There's more primarily women and children waking up in the morning feeling tired, the children not growing fully, not having full brain development, tragically, for the want of a few micronutrients, a few minerals and vitamins in their diet. This is unbelievable. It's the world's biggest health problem by a mile. A long way. And primarily affects the poor third of the planet, the poorer third of the planet. And so we need more fresh fruits and vegetables. We need more nuts. We need more pulses, legumes. And so this technology can make a real contribution to that. So that's what we're focusing on the plant side of things. Yeah.
Which is amazing. And I would just say that even with the global north problem, malnutrition is the number one cause of death globally, whether it's with heart disease or obesity or just food in general. The way we eat has a huge effect on our lives, and we should notice that a little bit more, I think.
Yes, right? There's now more people waking up overweight than waking up hungry. That's true.
It's unbelievable.
But there is the hidden hunger aspect, which I find particularly pernicious. Yeah, 60% of children in Pakistan do not have enough iron and vitamin A for their growth and mental development. Go to these countries, you'll see a lot of little fellas running around. They're little.
And we're in 2023.
In 2023. Yeah.
Yeah. There is a lot of work to do, huh?
Yes, and we all just try to do a little bit. And I guess what we're trying to do is, help try to increase the accessibility of quality food and try to reduce the environmental footprint of the provision of that food.
That is, I think, a very key objective for all of us, regardless of where we live. It's an extreme objective, and kudos to you. And in that, I literally wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
I'm just going to go to another topic that it's relevant and related, I would say. But in about a month ago, you were very kind to host me for the Chaos Workshop, which was wonderful. Thank you again.
Thank you for coming.
And you obviously were instrumental in putting this event together. So can you tell us a little bit about the event and what were the key takeaways?
Yes, it's actually one of the things at the very beginning of our conversation, we're talking about how to deliver impact. And there are multiple ways of delivering impact through education, collaboration, and spin out companies. And I did mention the fourth way, which is policy and providing advice on policy. Perhaps the most important of all of the pathways of impact. And in Saudi Arabia, it's still a young country and it's still very rapidly developing, even though it's coming with a very significant wealth. And it can also have regional leadership and set a good example through policies. For example, they have the Saudi Green Initiative, and then that led to the Middle East Green Initiative, where they're trying to promote environmental restoration, habitat restoration. Fantastic. And so, in fact, I was involved in providing some advice for the Saudi Green Initiative. And in the process of doing that, I was thinking, gosh, some of these things are really important and some of them are very impactful, where relatively modest policy is very impactful. And I can make some contributions, provide advice based on scientific knowledge and based on technological opportunities, and try to expose decision makers, leaders to some of the ways they can have a huge impact on sustainability, environmental issues through sometimes relatively quite simple and quite low impact changes in policy. So food security is a concern in the Middle East, and I think rightly. But as we were saying earlier, food security is often confused with food self-sufficiency. And this, especially in the context of this region where there's so little water, growing things locally really is extremely fraught because of the demands of water, especially in open fields. And so I felt like I could try to make a contribution to improving sustainability and security, damn it all, in the region by improving communication, increasing communication with decision makers and with the wider network of people in that food sector. So last year,
we had people from everywhere.
Yes, that's correct, of course. That means every human, because we all consume food every day and we make a high impact on that. We do our best, we try. That's true. And going through schools and doing outreach into schools is very important. But there's some things which are more urgent than that. In this region, there'll be no groundwater left by the time those school kids have grown up and are changing eating behavior. So we have to do things more urgently as well. So last year we did a science-focused, policy-related workshop here at KAUST. And then this year we went out, connected with Miwa, who I have to say were very hospitable and very receptive. That's good. In a way, we're pushing at an open door, which is great. And we had a joint workshop. You attributed earlier KAUST. It was a KAUST-Miwa collaboration initiated from KAUST, but with Miwa being very supportive, from the minister to everybody in that ministry. And we're starting to increase our focus on trying to use science and technology to inform policy.
So is it going to happen again next year?
So I think that's very likely. How it will happen could actually become quite exciting, because in fact it was announced at our workshop, at our Saudi Food Futures workshop, as we called it, and that the ministry is wanting to establish a national agri-food alliance. And that national agri-food alliance will build on the Saudi Food Futures. It will be led by Miwa, facilitated by KAUST. Things are moving and developing, which is just fantastic. And that National Agri-Food Alliance will become a very significant organization involving all the stakeholders, so ministry, industry, consumers, and of course the research and development sector as well.
Which is brings back to what you said initially, collaborations and partnerships.
That's amazing. Okay, it's fantastic they're doing this. Really fantastic. Yeah.
It's extremely important when you see all the different stakeholders come together for a common goal that is needed, necessary, and key to getting things done. Because as you said, you can have the greatest innovations, but then if you don't have policy that carries them through and regulates them, then...
Absolutely. It's incumbent on us ultimately to deliver. But yes, sometimes that delivery pathway can be very difficult. And policy is essential. Well, policy is essential for some things. You're completely right. And is massively helpful for a lot of other things to help improve things. Yeah.
If you had to travel, let's say, in the future, 5 years from now, what is it that you would like to see, whether obviously with the work that you're doing, both with Red Sea, but also with a collaboration, pretty much everything that we've discussed?
Gosh, what a good question. I would love to see all the greenhouses of the world and all the net houses of the world using heat blocking technologies the dairy are invented. I would love to see our rootstocks really making an impact on controlled environment and open field production. That's on the company side where I think we can make quite significant impact for a small group of people. And then on the policy side, just sticking with Saudi Arabia, where I have some level of knowledge, I would really hope that the controlled environment sector, and this actually isn't self-interest because we probably won't make sales here so much, but I would hope that the controlled environment sector is growing because I think that this is the most efficient way and the most water efficient way, perhaps I should say, of growing fresh fruit and vegetables. I would hope that Saudi has also developed a sophisticated import system and management system for the long shelf life grains. I would hope that we're eating a lot less meat globally because that really does have a big impact on the sustainability of our food sector. I would hope that we're substituting a lot of our meat with plant-based proteins over the next 5 years. And globally, oh goodness me, I really hope subsidies are highly pernicious. They're market distorting. And they're anti-innovation because subsidies reduce the incentive for farmers to adopt innovations. And so they're obviously market distorting, but it's much worse than that. And I would really hope that a lot, the US, Japan, Europe, Middle East, are really trying to work out mechanisms that are humane, sensitive, taking into account all of the social and economic issues that would be consequential of reducing subsidies. But I would really hope that we are much more actively phasing out subsidies. And we have systems in place also where it's not the planet that's paying the price for our food production, but we are paying the price for that food production.
Yeah. But you brought up a very good point in terms of subsidies, and in a way we have to figure out a scheme, a way to give incentives to shift towards, at least that's my opinion, towards different practices. If you've been an industrial type, conventional type farmer, and you want to move to regenerative, for example, agriculture, you can do that, but then you're at a loss, right? Because your livelihood for 1 or 2 years will obviously diminish. So you need to help sustainability, but not like we've been doing till now, right? Where it's just upward with subsidies. That's right. That's
why we have to develop business systems that are going to be promoting sustainability but making ultimately business sense.
Yes.
Because that's the only ultimate sustainable system is one which is both environmentally and economically sustainable.
Yes. Not just one or the other, which unfortunately is how we've been doing things thus far.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say there are a lot of money and not sustainable, or you think just about sustainability and it doesn't make you any money. So at the end of the day, then nobody does it.
Not really. Not enough people. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Not enough people. Yeah, it's not the small little farmer with his little orchard that's going to really make an impact. Right.
I mean, you can lead by example, and there can be a ripple effect from that small farmer doing the right things. But it's slow.
Yeah.
I think the German, yes. I don't know if it's Germans, so Europeans bringing in a carbon charging system over the next couple of years, I think that's going to be very, like a cross-border carbon charging system. This is going to be very interesting to see how that plays out.
Yes, indeed. We need initiatives,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. That's policy leadership.
Exactly. But it all goes back to
the carbon charging, that's the giant in the room, personally. Yeah.
Yes. The whole carbon question. I mean, we need to see how we're going to navigate that, right? Because if not, it's the risk there is that we still have the big defining what that is without really then looking at sustainability, but more at greenwashing. So it's how do we navigate that? We'll have to see.
We greenwashing.
As long as there's some substance out there as well.
Indeed. So mindful of time, we have just a few minutes, but I always ask this question. So if you had a magic wand, what is the one thing that you would do? Which in a way we said with your 5-year vision, but what is the one thing that you would do today? Create makes happen. It's the wand. What's your wish?
Oh dear. Besides trying to help people think more and encourage young people more. Maybe that's a very positive, constructive one. Yes, that's right. And if you gave me a second wave of the wand, I do think we need to be paying the real price for our polluting behaviors.
Yes, I second that.
Carbon, water, nitrogen.
Everything.
The big three.
Just two copies.
Yes, habitat destruction. Not that there's much habitat left to destroy now, but yeah, paying the real price for the resources we're exploiting and educating young people more.
With that, thank you very much for being with us today.
My absolute pleasure, and thank you for having me. It's great to have your interest and to have a chance to discuss these, I think, very important matters.
It is. And if people want to visit, let's start with Red Sea. Where do they go?
Redsea.ag. AG is our primary website. And from there, you'll go to the various technologies that are inside our company.
Perfect. Europe. And then KAUST.
KAUST is just KAUST, .edu.sa, SA for Saudi Arabia.
Perfect. And if they want to connect with you, well, your LinkedIn is... A tester will put that down into the notes.
You can Google me. There's a fair bit out there.
Cool. Thank you
absolute
so very
pleasure,
much.
Shannon. Thank you.
Want a deep dive into food innovation? Subscribe to the Food Tech Junkies series. Tune in and listen to the industry's champions, whose mission is to reinvent our future by collaborating and disrupting the status quo as a way to rebalance our planet and our daily lives. For more great food and ag tech content, visit our website at www.edibleplanetventures.com, and don't forget to follow us on social media.